Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. People often complain about being tired and burnout these days from work and family responsibilities. We think it's because of the way technology has sped up the pace of life and the way we're always on and figure we're living in the most exhausting age in history. But are we really? My guest argues that no, people have been complaining about being tired since at least antiquity. Her name is Anna Schaffner, and she's written a book called Exhaustion, A History, which traces the fascinating evolution of physical, psychological, and existential fatigue from the ancient Greeks to the modern day. Today, she takes us on this tour. And as we move from age to age, we dig into how exhaustion has changed as to how it's described, whether we blame external or internal factors as its source, and how much we believe personal agency can control it. After the show's over, check out the show notes at aom.is/exhaustion. Anna joins me now via Skype. All right, Anna Katharina Schaffner, welcome to the show.
Hi, welcome. Thank you for having me on your program.
So you wrote a book called Exhaustion, A History. I'm curious, this is an interesting topic to delve into the history of exhaustion. So what got you looking into that? Were you just really tired one day and you were thinking, did the ancient Greeks like complain about being tired of being tired too? And I'm going to explore that. So what happened there?
Yeah, it wasn't quite like that, but it was similar. I did often, you know, feel very exhausted and tired and weary and overburdened, you know, as academics tend to at numerous times in their lives. And I also noticed a really interesting increase in newspaper reports and television programs and scholarly studies on stress and burnout, especially in Germany. The Germans were really, really obsessed with that topic a couple of years ago. And everybody basically said that we've never, ever been that exhausted collectively, that we're living the most exhausting age ever. And that basically, you know, everything about our time was sucking out our energies, and that we're confronted with this really demanding environment in which we constantly have to be cognitively switched on. And new technologies basically mean that we can never properly switch off. And also, you know, neoliberal working arrangements were, you know, psychosocially really, really stressful. So everybody was making these big grand claims about our utterly exhausted and exhausting age. And then I did think, yeah, I mean, I agree with that. But I do wonder really whether exhaustion as a sort of mental and physical state is unique to our age. And then I thought I'd look into it. I was really interested. And then I really did find that exhaustion is really a topic that has concerned people throughout the centuries. And it is not, as we might think, related to new technologies. It is not related to the sort of hyper-competitive neoliberal environment, but it's really a ubiquitous and timeless concern. And I think, you know, I don't deny that we're living in a stressful age, and that there are numerous new psychosocial challenges that are very unique and specific to our times. But I did find that every age has sort of struggled with its own burden and its own challenges. And every age has also perceived itself as exhausting. And a lot of people before us have actually made similar claims as to, you know, how suddenly everything was terrible and they look back nostalgically to the past, imagining the past as much more kind of peaceful, less stressful. So you have this sort of nostalgic glorification of the past as a, you know, as an age in which the stressors were fewer. And that happens in lots of different periods, not just in ours. And basically, I was really fascinated with that, because that's not how most people perceive it. And I did also find that quite soothing as an idea, you know, that we're not the only age that has struggled with the problem of exhaustion.
So, yeah, this was, I thought it was soothing, too. It's like, well, you know, people thousands of years ago also were tired, just like I am. So let's talk about that. When was the first time we see in, you know, recorded human record of people complaining about being tired or exhaustion?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that really, you know, my investigation, my research took me all the way back to the age of classical antiquity. And you really do find it in some of the epics. You find it also in Galen's writing, you know, this great doctor who basically established humoral medicine, and he was looking at exhaustion in the context of melancholia, because basically exhaustion, you never really encounter it purely on its own in the literature of the past, in the medical text or in the theological text or in the philosophical text. What I did is I looked at different syndromes that entailed exhaustion as a core symptom. So I looked at texts on melancholia, I looked at texts on neurasthenia, on nervous weakness, on depression, on chronic fatigue syndrome, and on burnout. And exhaustion is always central to these syndromes, but it's not the same, of course, because in those syndromes, it is always combined with other symptoms. And sometimes these symptoms are thought to be the cause of exhaustion, is the cause of these other symptoms. And sometimes exhaustion is thought to be one of the consequences of them. So it's always really interesting. And one of the earliest writing, coming back to your question about exhaustion, is really in the sort of humoral medical texts on melancholia. And humoral medicine is really based on the idea that we have four humors that need to be in balance with one another, and all illnesses, all distress, all forms of discomfort can be explained with recourse to imbalance. So Galen thought that exhaustion, and mainly in the form of torpor, lethargy, weariness, and pessimism, is one of the core symptoms of melancholia. And he had a lot to write about exhaustion in the sense that he thought it was caused by a surplus of black bile. And he had also this very lovely image of how black moods and pessimistic worldviews happen. He basically thought that when the body is confronted with too much black bile, it starts to burn the excess of black bile, and the fumes of black bile, they sort of rise up into our head and literally cloud our vision. You know, they make us see everything through a glass darkly. So Galen was one of the very first to write about exhaustion. And he had this interesting idea that it was partly physical, you know, this idea that it was because of an imbalance of the humors and an excess of black bile, but that this physical imbalance obviously had effects on people's mental life. So it really manifested itself as a lack of energy, but also as a mood disorder, so to say.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting point, because that's something that I noticed throughout the book is, as you go through the different stages of civilization and how they approached exhaustion, there was this, I don't know, a tension between whether exhaustion or depression or whatever you want to call it is physiological, right? It's in the body, or if it's psychological, it's just in the mind or spiritual. So it sounds like Galen was saying it was a little bit of both at the time.
Yeah, I mean, he thought it was originally physical, but then had psychological impacts. And what is really interesting is how that relationship between the physical, the mental, and the social shifts in the different theories of exhaustion. And basically, in my book, I look at forms of exhaustion that constitute physical and mental states, and that are all also at the same time broader cultural phenomena. So physically, exhaustion really manifests itself as fatigue, lethargy, and weakness. And it can be a temporary state, and those aren't particularly scary because they pass, or that kind of state of exhaustion can be a chronic condition. And in my book, I really look at the pathological forms of exhaustion and those that are not obviously the result of an underlying and clearly diagnosable medical condition. And emotionally, exhaustion can be described as weariness, disillusionment, apathy, and hopelessness or a lack of motivation. And what I find really fascinating that is that throughout the ages, the different theories always theorized the relationship between the mind, the body, and the social very, very differently. And that was for me the attraction about that topic because, you know, the ways in which we think about the interconnection between the mind, the body, and the social is really, really interesting. And it also tells us a lot about other assumptions about, you know, selfhood and, you know, how connected we are. And also, you know, the kind of whole idea, the Cartesian idea of a split between the mind and the body is obviously a later phenomenon. And most of the earlier texts and theories are much more holistic. And they assume that there's a sort of intricate connection between the mind and the body. And they try to sort of theorize that connection in very interesting ways.
And also, so there's this tension between mind and body, but there's also, you see throughout the history, and we see it even with the ancient and classical antiquity, whether exhaustion is a sign of weakness, right? Of like a moral failing, or if it's just something that just happens to you and you're pretty much blameless for it. And that changes. But before we see how it changes, like what did like say the ancient Greeks or the ancient Romans think of exhaustion? Was it seen as a moral failing or a moral weakness of some sort? Or was it just something like, well, yeah, that just happens to you and that's okay?
Yeah, I think it wasn't seen as a moral failing and it was also not considered as weakness as such. It was something that started out in the body. And I mean, they did believe that you could cure exhaustion and melancholic states by paying attention to diet, by living a very moderate lifestyle, you know, avoiding excesses of all sorts. So there was an idea that our behavior contributes to our exhaustion if we're not careful, if we, you know, eat the wrong kinds of food, if we indulge in, you know, activities that are not restful, if we don't pay attention to our energy levels, that we are partly responsible for suffering from exhaustion and states of exhaustion. But the other interesting thing about melancholia, because, you know, melancholia was the big sort of exhaustion syndrome in that period, was that melancholia also had a vaguely positive connections back then already, because Aristotle actually connected melancholia and the melancholic temperament with genius. So being melancholic wasn't just seen as something negative. There was also this, you know, connection with scholarship and with creativity and with, you know, intellectual powers. But overall, I would say exhaustion in the Greco-Roman period wasn't vilified. It wasn't considered sinful. It wasn't considered a weakness. It was rather about sort of temperament and physical responses that we can influence by watching our behavior. But it didn't have these sort of excessive moralistic connotations that came with later diagnoses.
And so, yeah, let's talk about that change. That started changing in the Middle Ages with Christianity.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's for me probably the most interesting theory of exhaustion, the idea that exhaustion is sinful. And medieval exhaustion was actually really present in a syndrome cluster that is called achedia, and that was later renamed as sloth. So achedia really was born amongst hermit monks in the Egyptian desert, and early theorists, including Evagrius Ponticus and Johannes Cassian, who lived in the Egyptian desert, blamed exhaustion on the noonday demon. And achedia is really a very interesting phenomenon. It's a mixture of melancholia and sloth, and it was thought to be manifest in listlessness, apathy, and lack of care. And it was originally diagnosed exclusively in monastic environments, but then it became sort of more ubiquitous and became democratized, and everyone was able to suffer from achedia. And achedia has also very poetically been described as weariness of the heart. And the 13th century Italian theologian Thomas Aquinas was the first to very, very explicitly define achedia as a spiritual sin. And I think that was a really interesting turn in the history of exhaustion, because he thought exhaustion was a failure of morality and it was owing to a lack of proper faith. So basically the exhausted, the lethargic, the lukewarm, the weary were guilty of refusing to accept divine grace. They were basically guilty of a bad mental attitude. And in fact, very few people know that akedia or sloth was considered the most dangerous of the seven deadly sins. And it was the most dangerous because it basically breeds all the other bad behaviors and the other sinful forms of acting, because it can all be traced back to this lack of faith in God's goodness, this sort of, you know, dismissive attitude about what is good and what is important and what is divine. And the underlying idea was also, of course, that by giving in to exhaustion, we are guilty because we are weak, our flesh is weak, our mental state is weak, and we let the sort of evil forces from the outside take over because we're not vigilant enough and we don't have enough faith to fend off, you know, the noonday demon, for example. And of course, that has implications for responsibility and agency. I mean, one of the other interesting things about exhaustion is that it always brings up bigger philosophical questions about personal responsibility and agency. And in the Middle Ages, really, the slothful and the ascetic and the, you know, weary and lethargic were thought of as sinners.
So what's interesting, you talk about Italians in the medieval times, is Dante and his Divine Comedy. Like, exhaustion was front and center in that. What can the Divine Comedy teach us about how people living in that period thought you could overcome the sin of akedia?
Yeah, I when I reread the Divine Comedy, I was really struck by how, you know, it can really be read as a book that traces the gradual overcoming of weariness, of spiritual and physical weariness. And there are lots and lots of reference to sleepiness, to lethargy, to tiredness, to heaviness. And Dante, you know, he sheds all his sins on the way to paradise. So he you know, he's lost spiritually and literally at the beginning of the Divine Comedy. And then he meets his guide who, you know, basically guides him through the inferno and to purgatory, and in the end he, you know, he's reunited with his beautiful Beatrice in paradise. And in the course of his journey, he becomes more and more energetic, and he shakes off this torpor, this lethargy, and it becomes very clear that exhaustion and in the form of akedia and slothfulness has been his major sin. And he encounters lots of other slothful characters in the course of his journey, all of whom get punished. You know, there's this sort of law of contrapasso at work in the Divine Comedy, this idea that all the sins are punished by tortures that either resemble or contrast with the sin in question. So some of the weary and slothful characters are forced into eternal activity. And the lukewarm, who never really wanted to commit to, you know, to God's goodness or to good causes, they're forced endlessly to run after empty banners, for example, which is a very beautiful image, I think. And then, of course, Dante also encounters the wonderful figure of Bell'Acqua, who, you know, who sits really tired and lethargic and weary at the bottom of Mount Purgatory. And if he were able to climb up to the summit of Mount Purgatory, he could really find salvation there. But ironically, he's just too tired to make that climb, and he can't be bothered, and he doesn't really believe that, you know, he would succeed in being forgiven for his sins. So he just sits there at the bottom of Mount Purgatory with his, you know, with his head bowed and, you know, leaning against a boulder in the shade, this wonderful image of someone who has really given up on the idea of salvation. But not so Dante, you know, who is driven forward by Virgil, his guide, and who in the end succeeds in shaking off his torpor, his spiritual torpor, and recommits to God in the end.
I think it was interesting, you know, you mentioned that the sin of slothfulness originated in monastic scenarios or environments. When I was reading this, I was actually, at the time, I stayed in a monastery here in close by to my house, just like an hour away. And one of the things I found was interesting. I got there, like, all I wanted to do was sleep. Like, the day before I was fine, like, you know, active, but like I got there And I just got really sleepy. I just wanted, I wonder if it's something about the monastic way of life that it is so regular and it is so, I don't know, it is kind of relaxing. That just makes you tired. It makes you want to sleep. I don't know what was going on there.
Yeah, I kind of mentioned that, you know, if you have very kind of regular routines, and also, you know, they had to meditate a lot, the monks in the past, you know, they, especially the hermits, they were by themselves all day long, every day. And they had to be really, really disciplined about their kind of spiritual commitments and the meditation aspect of it. And of course, that can be really, really hard and can cause incredible problems with concentration. And there's some wonderful descriptions of weary monks in some of the texts I studied, you know, monks who basically engage in all sorts of very modern sounding displacement activities. You know, they go out and they stare at the sun and they become really sleepy, and then they go and see another monk and idly chat for hours, and then they feel really tired again. And, you know, there are all these descriptions of monks who don't quite manage to commit to that, you know, very rigorous discipline that was required. And then, of course, I think what also becomes interesting is that in a monastic setting, you know, because the sort of hermitages, the hermit monks, they were obviously all living separately in their own little, I'm not entirely sure how, cells in the desert. Yeah. But then when Christianity became more broadly organized around monasteries, the lazy monk became a big social problem, you know, because monasteries depend on everybody chipping in, everybody doing their job, everybody contributing to the community. And the one lazy monk could cause a lot of resentment. I mean, that's, you know, as is still the case nowadays.
All right. So during the medieval time, Middle Ages, exhaustion was seen as a spiritual, it's a weakness of the will. As we shift into the Renaissance, though, again, we see exhaustion changing. So how did it change during the Renaissance?
Yeah, I actually studied a really interesting text by a 15th century humanist called Marsilio Ficino. He wrote a text that is called Three Books on Life. And Ficino was a Neoplatonist and was very, very interested in occult theories. He was into alchemy, and he was into you know, astronomy, astrology, all of these slightly more obscure sciences. And he profoundly believed in the sort of microcosm macrocosm connection. And his main cure for exhaustion was really the idea that we need to realign our patterns of behavior with the movements of the planets. So he believed that exhaustion, in the form of melancholia, was caused by the planet Saturn, and that, you know, Saturn really, really held sway over the melancholic temperaments, and that basically people with a melancholic temperament needed to do quite a lot to counteract the influence of Saturn. And he came up with fantastically obscure recipes for what the melancholics should do. And he also recommended, which is one of my favorite cures for exhaustion, Orphic dancing. And Orphic dancing is all about realigning your energy with the energy of the planet. So he recommended that we imitate the movement of the planets by moving our body in a certain way. So reading Ficino is actually very entertaining nowadays.
And one of the things, so it sounds like here, instead of seeing as exhaustion as the source, being the individual being the source of exhaustion, like the planets, where it was like an outside source that caused you to be really tired.
Yeah, I think that's another, you know, that's another really interesting factor in the history of exhaustion, where responsibility shifts from inner sources to outer sources. You know, sometimes they can be environmental, like the planets, and very often they can be very specific socio-political developments, as we will see later on. So, for example, in the 19th century, when theorists began to talk about nerves, weak nerves, and nerve force, and a lack of nerve force, and they started to think of exhaustion as basically being caused by a lack of nervous energy, a lack of nerve power, lack of nerve force. And they very, very explicitly blamed this lack of nerve force on the modern urban environment. And that was, you know, the sort of first very clear-cut reassignment of responsibility to something that is outside of our control. You know, basically the theories of the theorists of nervous exhaustion were all saying that we are victims of socio-political developments and technological developments. Most famous amongst these was, of course, the American physician George N. Beard, who coined the neurasthenia diagnosis in 1880. So he invented this new diagnostic cluster, neurasthenia, which included all sorts of things. I mean, it's absurdly long and absurdly, you know, wide-ranging, and it's no longer in use because it basically included far too many symptoms. So it became very kind of baggy as a concept. But what is interesting about neurasthenia was that it was very clearly saying that the main cause of nervous exhaustion is to be found in the modern urban environment. And the idea was that the modern urban environment assaults the highly sensitive nervous system of modern men and women with an incessant stream of stimuli. So, you know, Beard was worried about speed, he was worried about noise, he was worried about the telegraph, he was worried about all sorts of technological developments and how they basically kind of overstimulate our cognitive systems. But Beard was also very clever because he associated neurasthenia with a whole range of very positive connotations as well, because he said only the very sensitive types actually suffer from neurasthenia. So everybody, of course, wants to be sensitive and cultured and civilized. And that was one of the reasons for why neurasthenia became a very, very fashionable disease. It actually spread like a wildfire. Everybody wanted to be neurasthenic because being neurasthenic meant you were sensitive, you were in touch with your emotions, you weren't crude, you were highly civilized, you were sophisticated. And he also said neurasthenia mainly affects captains of industry and brain workers.
I think that's interesting because you see that also, like going back to Aristotle, right? Being a melancholic, tired guy, well, it's a sign of genius. The Renaissance had that same idea. The Romantics as well in the 19th century, if you were, you know, had a depressive outlook on life, well, it meant you were poetic, right? And it became fashionable to do that. And you see that also with neurasthenia.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the United States? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. So I got a tree from Fast Growing Trees. I had a tree in my front yard that had to cut down, a big giant oak tree because it died, and I wanted to put a maple tree there, one that turned bright red during the fall. So I found that tree, made sure that it fit the climate that we're at here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, ordered it. A few days later, I got the tree in a box. It's crazy they can send a tree in a box. And I planted it. A few weeks after I planted it, it's already starting to sprout leaves. So I think in a few years, I'm going to have that bright red maple tree that happens in the fall. I'm really looking forward to that. So if you want to try Fast Growing Trees out, this spring they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off with their first purchase when using code manliness at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using code manliness at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code manliness. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code manliness to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code manliness. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. There have been a lot of amazing people as guests on this podcast, but what if you want to go deeper? If you're looking somewhere to learn from the most remarkable people, that's Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 200 classes to pick from, with new classes added every month, and they have over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. For example, Chris Voss has a class on negotiation, Jocko Willink has a class on leadership, and Malcolm Gladwell has a class on writing. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. One class that I've really enjoyed is the one with Chris Voss on negotiation. My favorite lesson in that class was the lesson on tactical empathy. It's something we talked about in the podcast that we did with him a long time ago, but he goes in deeper with this. And besides just the lectures, you get exercises so you can actually put this stuff into practice. Right now, listeners will get an additional 15% off annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. And now back to the show. What's interesting too is not only how we think about exhaustion changes, but like the metaphors we use to talk about exhaustion. So like in the 19th century, you mentioned that people started talking about nerve force or nerve power. Well, like electricity was invented in the 19th century or thereabouts, like, you know, people started having it in their homes. So that they started using that as a way to explain exhaustion, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the metaphors of exhaustion are really, really crucial, because metaphors really matter, especially in the field of medicine, because they really shape the way we imagine what is happening inside us. So, you know, if we imagine our nervous capital as comparable to a battery, for example, that has lots of implications. I mean, the battery, the empty battery, was a very, very popular image that Beard used, you know, also in response to the spread of electricity and related technologies. But the empty battery was very, very popular back then as an image that, you know, sort of captured what happens if we don't manage our nerve force carefully. And of course, the idea was that batteries are, you know, I think they were non-rechargeable back then, I'm not entirely sure, but, you know, the idea was that nerve force is finite. It cannot easily be renewed. It's a precious resource, and if we squander it, we will be left with nothing. So another very popular metaphor cluster that was used a lot in the 19th century was revolving around economic imagery. So the idea that we have, that we have an account and we have to manage it wisely. So we have to manage our nervous energy just as wisely as we would manage our financial assets, because if we squander it all at once, it's gone and we're bankrupt. So, you know, I think George Beard even uses the term nervous bankruptcy at some point. And he often makes these economic comparisons, which again, you know, implies agency, that, you know, although he blames exhaustion mainly on the modern environment, there's always a dimension of agency involved, because otherwise, if we had no agency, we couldn't defend ourselves against exhaustion. You know, we can't just be victims in this. There has to be something we can do about it. So he's very much in favor of managing our nervous energy very cautiously, very wisely, very, very astutely. And other really interesting images that the medieval theorists used, one of my favorites is really the idea of the tepid bowl of milk on which flies settle. That is, I think it's from the 11th century, if I remember correctly. And this is the idea that, you know, if we let our spiritual essence go sour, we will attract demonic and disgusting outside forces. And I think it's a very powerful image. The tepid bowl of milk on which flies settle. And of course, other really interesting and important metaphors are related to, I mean, modern day ones would be related to the mind as a computer. And that has lots of implications as well. Imagining the mind as a computer is very reductive, I think very worrying, because, you know, it just entails that we can reprogram our cognitive structures, and we can get rid of unwanted data, and we can delete and, you know, reload, and we can recharge and reprogram, and we can basically get rid of everything we don't like. But I think it really doesn't capture the human animal as a very kind of irrational creature. We're not just rational, and we can't just be easily reprogrammed, you know, and we're not robots. But I think the idea of the mind as a computer, and that's very popular in the sort of modern burnout literature, is quite a dangerous one, because it really dismisses everything that makes us human.
Well, no, yeah, I think I've seen devices you can buy. I don't know if it exists anymore. It was out there. I remember seeing a viral article about it. It's this little device you kind of stick to your forehead, and then it sends like electric pulses into your brain. And it can somehow energize you or like make you calm. So like it's that idea like, oh, yeah, you can just reprogram your brain like it's some sort of digital device with electrical currents.
Yeah. Interestingly, George M. Beard, the inventor of the neurasthenia diagnosis, he used electrotherapy for the exhausted. And that was one of his, therapeutic suggestions, like mild electric shocks.
Yeah. And so besides the electrotherapy, there was also hydrotherapy. So
yeah, hydrotherapy was another popular, you know, cure for exhaustion. In fact, the cures that were proposed for exhaustion are also really interesting in themselves. So taking the waters was very, very popular in 19th century Britain. So Darwin, for example, also suffered from exhaustion, and he often took the waters. So he indulged in water cures numerous times in his life. And he was also very cautious about managing his energy. So he would always have very rigorous periods of activity and periods of rest, periods of activity, periods of rest. So reading his letters, it's very fascinating, because he was really extremist about the way he organized his leisure time and his work time, for example. Yeah, and then there are, you know, more obscure suggestions for curing exhaustion, you know, lots of potions, lots of strange alchemical mixtures. And of course, in the Middle Ages, I think that was probably the cruelest cure, because the cure was just more work, more spiritual exercise. So, you know, those who were exhausted by their spiritual duties were just told to focus even harder on their spiritual duties, or to work even harder. So that was, of course, a vicious circle.
So in the late 19th century, exhaustion was seen as neurasthenia. And exhaustion is one of the symptoms of neurasthenia. There's a whole bunch of other symptoms that associate with it. But then, as you notice, as you note in the book, in the 20th century, like, neurasthenia almost disappeared. Like after World War I, what happened? And like, or did it just exhaustion change the way it was described or talked about?
Yeah, I think what always happens is that, you know, certain diagnoses, they run their course, and new ones emerge. I mean, we can even see that nowadays, you know, where the DSM constantly comes up with new diagnoses and gets rid of older ones and so on. So there's always an attempt to, you know, to redesign, refashion our diagnostic tools in order to capture what is bothering us in more, you know, modern, more, you know, accurate terms. And I think that is true of exhaustion as well. But one of the reasons why neurasthenia disappeared from the scene was that, I mean, also the gender politics of exhaustion are very interesting. So neurasthenia was associated with women, and the rest cure was often proposed for neurasthenic women. And Charlotte Perkins Gilman wrote a very famous story about that, the Yellow Wallpaper. And then the kind of gender politics of exhaustion changed, in that quite a lot of sensitive men began to self-identify as neurasthenics, quite a lot of artists, quite a lot of writers. It was very fashionable to be neurasthenic for a long time. You know, most most of the, you know, turn of the century writers would self-identify as neurasthenic because it was just en vogue to do so. But then there was a shift and neurasthenia was beginning to be, and people felt it was too baggy to lose a diagnosis. And it was also associated with shirkedom. You know, obviously during the First World War and after, there was much less tolerance for you know, suffering of the soul, but because it all became very, very kind of physically orientated, outwards oriented. And of course, Freud had entered the scene by then. And Freud really shifted the discourse very dramatically. And he came up with some very revolutionary ideas about exhaustion. So Freud, obviously, he came up with three core ideas. So he did say that it's very exhausting constantly having to repress our desires because we have to do that because we live in, you know, in a society that depends on individuals repressing their selfish desires. But repressing those desires makes us neurotic because, you know, they have to somehow, the forbidden wants out and it becomes manifest in neuroses, for example. And it also becomes manifest in sublimation, of course, but it doesn't always work. And then we can end up suffering from exhaustion as a result. But his more interesting theories about exhaustion concerned, of course, his sort of meta-psychological idea of the death drive. So he famously argued that there's a life drive, you know, that is responsible for us striving, for us wanting to procreate, for us wanting to be active and do things. And he also said that this drive is countered by its opposite drive, the death drive. And the death drive wants to return us to a state of passivity, a state of inertia, an anorganic state. It wants to return us to basically a state before individuation, before we became separate, before we became, you know, individuals. And he argues that both drives are conservative and they battle against one another, which is quite exhausting because you have these conflicting drives that are operative within us. And also sometimes the death drive takes over and it takes us into a lethargic state where we want to avoid all activity, all novelty, all challenge, where we just want to basically return to a state where nothing disturbs our peace, you know, where we seek a sort of fake kind of nirvana by avoiding anything that might be upsetting or challenging or threatening. You know, and you can still say about certain people, oh, they're very death-driven, you know, in the sense that they have become extremely passive and averse to challenges and averse to anything that is associated with life and novelty. And of course, Freud also came up with the idea of conflict inside us that can eat up all our energy, that can use up all of our power in internal battles. So he famously sort of theorized the id, the ego, and the superego as psychological instances. And he also argued that they can do battle with one another, you know, that the id and the ego and the ego and the superego can be in conflict. And that takes up a lot of energy, energy that, you know, is then wasted and cannot be invested into any interactions with the outside world. So this, I think this idea of internal conflict eating up our energy is also quite interesting. And then he also talked about melancholia and the idea that losing a love object can often result in us losing a stable sense of self. And it's a very complicated process of substitution, but it can happen that we become so eaten up by loss that this kind of obsession with loss has an effect on our sense of self. And when we've lost our sense of self, we can basically no longer properly interact with the outside world because we have used up our energy in psychological conflict operations.
All right. So yeah, Freud changed the game big time. He added to the idea that exhaustion can come from within based on all these conflicts. And I can see that happening, right? Because like, you know, Freud changed the way we thought about ourselves, right? Or talk about ourselves. And I can see people being like, yeah, I got to sort out this problem, this internal problem. Before Freud, they would never have thought of it. But now that Freud says, oh, it's there. And you're like, okay, maybe it is there. this is one more thing I have to think about. That makes me tired. So we're just adding to it.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, it's, you can really see that at work, I think, in everyday life, when, you know, when people are really preoccupied with their own problems to such an extent that they really cannot give to anybody else or to outside activities. I still find it a very convincing narrative personally.
So let's talk about recent developments in the history of fatigue and exhaustion, because it's been controversial. In the 80s, we start seeing people talking about chronic fatigue syndrome. For those who aren't familiar with this, like what is chronic fatigue syndrome? Like, what does it feel like to have chronic fatigue syndrome? Do we know what causes it, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, chronic fatigue syndrome is, of the different exhaustion syndromes I discuss in my book, it's by far the most controversial one. And it is, in terms of symptoms, it is similar to some of the others, similar to neurasthenia, similar. There's overlap with some of the older ones as well. But basically, ME, or chronic fatigue syndrome, means that people who are afflicted by these syndromes suffer from mental and physical fatigue and also post-exertion malaise and a sense of extreme effort that renders many everyday activities impossible. And it also entails difficulties with concentrating, cognitive tasks, and short-term memory. And it is a highly controversial diagnosis, because there were quite a few people, especially in the 80s, who were very unsympathetic to people who suffered from CFS or ME, as it is also known. And there are some differences between the two, but often people talk about ME/CFS, ME/chronic fatigue syndrome. And I think what happened in the 80s was that there was a very, very unsympathetic reaction in the press. People talked about yuppie flu and basically said it was a sham condition and that it was all in the sufferers' heads. And the problem is that nowadays the discussion about CFS and ME is very, very polarized. A lot of CFS and ME sufferers feel very strongly that theirs is a purely biological condition, a purely physical condition. And then there are some people who argue that there might be a psychological dimension to this illness. Nobody is saying that this is just in sufferers' heads. I think that, you know, very crude and horrible attitude has become unacceptable. But there are some people, some psychiatrists and some medical researchers who say, yes, there is some physiological cause to that illness, but then there may be a psychosomatic or a behavioral dimension to recovery from the physiological issue. Now, that the problem with CFS and ME is that it has become a very acrimonious debate, in that sufferers feel terribly misunderstood and misrepresented by the press in particular, but also by certain medical researchers. And they react very, very strongly to any suggestions that there may be a psychosomatic dimension to the recovery process, for example, or to the illness as such. I haven't taken a position on this in my book because I'm not a medical expert, and I really couldn't make a judgment on what is the true narrative here. I've simply presented the two arguments. I've presented the viewpoint of a sufferer, and I've presented the viewpoint of a psychiatrist who argues that there's a behavioral and psychological dimension to the illness, although this psychiatrist also never, ever says that it's all in sufferers' heads. However, I've been attacked horribly for my chapter on CFS and ME by some sufferers who hate it when you even mention the other viewpoint. As I said, I haven't actually made a judgment call. How could I? I think it is likely that there might be a biological cause for ME and CFS that hasn't yet been found. I very much hope that is the case, because that would mean that, you know, sufferers could be cured once that cause can be identified. At the same time, I think it's not in any way shameful to say that there is some psychological dimension to some of our conditions. I mean, I would always readily admit that my health is affected by my psychological state of mind. You know, when I'm stressed and anxious, my immune system is lower and I'm more likely to get ill. So I don't think it's a horrible thing to say that some of our illnesses may have a psychological dimension, you know, not as an exclusive cause, but as a contributing factor. But I think because ME and CFS patients have been treated so horribly by the press, the debate has become very, very polarized.
Yeah, I think what it also does too is it shows very acutely that tension between physiological and psychological. So if it's physiological, we tend to think we don't blame people as much. If it's psychological, we think, well, just get it together. You're responsible for that. But maybe that's the not, we shouldn't have that approach even to psychological issues.
Yeah, of course not. You know, and I think I find it surprising because, you know, people who suffer from depression, they would not be stigmatized. I mean, they still are in certain unfortunate scenarios. There is still a stigma that comes with mental health, but there shouldn't be, of course. And, you know, and depression also has some biological causes. And I think it's in most cases, we have a both and scenario, not a neither nor or either or scenario.
So chronic fatigue syndrome, the latest development one of the latest developments in how we experience exhaustion, describe it. But let's talk about the thing that got you thinking about this was all those articles that were going on in Germany about burnout. Because if you live in America too, we see those articles as well, that burnout is on the rise. So let's first talk about when we talk about burnout, what are we describing? How is it different from exhaustion in the past? Is it the same? Can you kind of walk us through that?
Yeah, so burnout is the latest exhaustion syndrome. And burnout is really very, very popular topic of conversation in, especially in the non-Anglo-American countries. I don't know whether a lot of people talk about burnout in the US, but I would say in the UK, the discussion tends to revolve around stress, which is much more about personal resilience and personal work-life balance management. But burnout, in the way it is discussed in Germany, for example, and also in some of the Scandinavian countries, has a dimension that we haven't seen so far, and that is it includes social structures. It includes the idea of working environments that can make us ill. And that's something quite new in the discussion. So burnout has been defined as basically a reaction to too much work stress. And the idea is that burnout entails three components, and that is exhaustion, that is an inability to perform one's job, and it is also a cynical attitude towards the people with whom one works. And I think that last dimension has to be explained, because originally the burnout diagnosis emerged in the 1970s in America in the context of care workers. So the idea was really that people who are in the caring professions, so teachers, social workers, nurses, and so on, tend to at some point become very disillusioned because they invest so much emotional energy in their work. And then often they don't get enough back, or else they work in an environment that, you know, really exploits them, and that means that they cannot continue to give quite that much emotional energy. And then in the 1980s and 90s, the diagnosis of burnout became democratized again and expanded to encompass all kinds of work. And ultimately, burnout is a chronic state of stress, but it is more specific than depression in that it relates particularly and very specifically to one's working environment. Now, a lot of people are happier to self-diagnose as burned out rather than depressed, because depression is still very clearly a mental health issue, whilst burnout can be actually turned into something positive, you know, like neurasthenia in its early days, because you can only burn out if you give too much, if you work too hard. And working too hard is, of course, something that is validated in our society that has very, very positive connotations. So in a way, you will find that people, you know, top managers and so on might be quite happy to self-diagnose as burned out, because in a way, it's almost a badge of honor. You have worked so hard, you've given so much more than you actually have, that you now need to rest, so that you now have to earn your, you know, your right to rest and to take a break.
So there we go again, exhaustion being a status symbol again. What I think is interesting too, is you see throughout human history with how we deal with exhaustion, like the cures, like they're pretty much the same. Like even today when we say I'm tired, I'm not talking about, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome, but just say you're just burnt out, you're feeling exhausted or you're stressed out. Like what would we do? Like, okay, eat better food, get more sleep. We do things like people are taking cold showers, or they're doing saunas, or what are those pods? Where you sit in and the float tanks.
Yeah.
Right. Or mindfulness. I'm going to meditate. It's different, but it is the same thing that, you know, Galen was doing basically 2000 years ago.
Absolutely. It's all about restoring some kind of balance, you know. But I think what is also really interesting is that burnout can be read in two ways. And I find that in Germany and in some Scandinavian countries, it has a more overtly political dimension, because basically people expect the state to step in and to protect workers against hostile working environments. So there's an expectation that somehow legislation will be changed in order to avoid these kind of epidemics of burnout amongst the workforce. So there is a very kind of specifically political spin to the burnout argument as well in sociological arguments, in particular, you know, which concern the, you know, the terrible neoliberal working environment in which we are expected to give permanently, in which we are expected to, you know, engage with our full being emotionally, cognitively, creatively, and of course the boundaries between work and leisure are constantly being eroded, and we have to be reachable, you know, 24/7. And so on. So in Germany, for example, quite a lot of companies have put into place measures to prevent staff burnout. For example, you know, saying it's not possible to send work emails after 7 p.m. So, you know, some companies have even manipulated their company emails accounts to such an extent that you cannot send after-hour emails. You cannot send or receive them. Or if you go on holidays, your emails will bounce back, so that you can actually really properly relax on holidays and you won't come back to a mountain of unanswered email. So, for example, my brother works at Mercedes and they have this wonderful, you know, bounce back holiday email system in operation. And, you know, everyone who's on holiday, they basically send an automatic message that says, I'm on holiday. If your concern is still of importance after 2 weeks, please get back to me. But everything bounces back. And so that's just one example of how basically it brings us back to the question of responsibility. You know, and in a lot of burnout discussions, responsibility is moved away from the individual and is basically placed in the court of the state and people or the company for which one works. So there is a sort of responsibility of care for the workers, you know, mental health and work-life balance. I find that in Anglo-American discussions, the focus is much more on personal resilience, which is all about personal responsibility. You know, if you're too stressed, if you get exhausted at work, it's your fault because you allow yourself to get so stressed. So you need to work on your own resilience. So you need to eat more greens. You need to meditate. You need to do yoga. It's all up to you. So I find that very interesting, the kind of responsibility question that is attached to the different cures.
Right. And so instead of saying, maybe I shouldn't get email after 7 o'clock, Americans are like, well, I just need to meditate so I can handle those emails after 7 o'clock. I mean, it's interesting because you do see companies in America instituting these meditation programs, nap rooms. And we had a guest on the podcast talk about this, like the happiness industry, where he says, yeah, I mean, it looks like they're helping you out. But like really it's helping their bottom line, right? Because they want you to be well rested and not stressed out, because that means you'll be more productive for them.
Exactly. It's all about enhancing productivity. You know, it's not really a concern about well-being. It's about, we want you to be able to keep on working
as long as you can. Yeah. So if you got to take a 20-minute nap, we're okay with that. So what do you think is the big takeaway from this research project? Is exhaustion just some part of the human existence that we have to deal with?
I absolutely think it is. I think exhaustion is a wonderful sort of both end phenomenon, in that it's timeless and ubiquitous, but it always puts on new clothes. So it's like an ancient beast that keeps appearing in new outfits. And I would say it hooks into, really basic psychological anxieties about illness, the waning of our energy when we die and when we grow old. And ultimately, it's about a fear of death. You know, losing energy is associated with a loss of control, a loss of our health, a loss of our powers. And, we only become concerned about exhaustion when we do feel that our energies are on the wane. So it's about, illness and the process of aging and fear of death. But at the same time, what I find so fascinating about exhaustion theories is that every age maps its own discontents onto the condition. So every age really projects whatever it wants to onto this sort of basic template. And every age kind of reassigns responsibility and rethinks the, mind, body, social nexus in a very unique and special way. And I have also found that exhaustion theories are often a form of cultural criticism. So people will critique social developments with which they disagree. So, for example, in the burnout debates, you have a lot of people, complaining about neoliberal techno-capitalist developments that they don't like, and they say these are the cause of our exhaustion. Or in the 19th century, you have people saying, women becoming emancipated and joining the workforce is terrible and it makes them exhausted. So exhaustion theories are often used as a sort of cultural weapon. They're weaponized in the sense that they underpin very specific ideological agendas.
Well, Anna, this has been a great conversation. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest today is Anna Schaffner. She's the author of the book Exhaustion. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can also check out our show notes at aom.is/exhaustion, where you can find links to resources, where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website, artofmanliness.com, where you can find thousands of in-depth, well-researched articles just about anything: personal finances, habit formation, how to be a better man, how to be a better family man, you name it, we've got it. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think would get something out of it. As always, thank you for continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay encouraging you to not only listen to the AOM podcast, but put what you've learned into action.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.